And what we mean by that is, in some jurisdictions, personnel are actually, their job at a scene is to convey information back and forth between jurisdictions. And when you can deliver a radio communication system to those individuals that allows them to actually work versus running back and forth to convey messages, you actually multiply your force and enhance the delivery of the services. Now, while the I-35W bridge collapse will forever be remembered for the tragic loss of 13 individuals and the dozens of other people that were injured in that event, from those people who were involved in radio communications, that was a large-scale landmark event that really, for the first time, jurisdictions, over 100 jurisdictions, were able to come together and effectively communicate and handle what was a very, very difficult scene. Again, 100 feet below the riverbanks, on the south side, on the north side, many, many jurisdictions. You had fires. You had a multitude of different events happening at that one event. And a radio system, the armor system, was in place that allowed all of those emergency responders to effectively communicate with each other. As a matter of fact, one of the emergency responders afterwards was quoted as saying, "We have removed communications as an element of failure in disasters. Now we can only blame our use of the system, not the technology." Very, very powerful quote about the power of the armor system and what it allowed those emergency responders the day of that particular event. 2 weeks after the bridge collapse, you may recall there was vast flooding down in the southeastern part of Minnesota. It was no surprise to us that the first issue that was identified in the flooding by the emergency responders was a lack of communication, the inability to communicate the needs and to deliver resources to where they needed to be. And that's an area of the state that we continue to build our armor system out right now. The armor system allows for a shared radio communication network between cities, counties, state authorities, federal authorities, and tribal responders. It is open for all government entities and non-governmental organizations with a public safety purpose to join and collaborate and communicate on a shared platform. This collaboration leads to emergency services being delivered better, faster, and cheaper than ever before. Those are my preliminary comments, and now I'd just kind of like to bring you back to about 18 months ago when I started in this role at the Department of Public Safety and where we are now. 18 months ago, we had two regional radio boards, the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board and the Central Minnesota Regional Radio Board. Today, Madam Chair and members, I'm happy to report that we have all 87 counties and a number of cities that are participating in regional governance structures. These joint power boards are made up of elected county officials and city council members. Their mission is to fill the interoperability gaps on a regional level and manage migration of their communities to the armor system. It's no small task to get over 80 county attorneys and a number of city attorneys to agree on joint powers language, but we've been able to do that. And the reason why we've been able to do that is because our local officials have recognized the significant public safety issue that not only they face in their communities, but their emergency responders face, their neighbors face at these events. And that's why these elected officials, these county commissioners and city council members are willing to dedicate time to solving these issues by serving on these regional radio boards. These boards are nation-leading. And what I mean by that is this robust level of governance structure is unlike any place in the country. As a matter of fact, tomorrow I will be traveling to New Orleans. The National Governors Association has invited me to come and speak on our governance structure and to share our successes with other states. I will note they are paying my bill to travel there. But I have also traveled to the state of Missouri, the state of Iowa. Iowa has basically called us and said, "We want to do everything that you're doing because from our standpoint, you're doing it right." And that's not a testament to me. It's a testament to all of the people over the last 20 years that have come together to solve these issues. I've also spoken over the phone with the states of Oregon, Montana, and Virginia. And recently at a conference, I had a chance to talk with many of my colleagues from across the country, and many of them are very intrigued by our successes that we've had. 18 months ago, we had five counties that were operating on the armor system. Today, over 20 counties are either on the ARMR system or have committed through a resolution of their county board to join the ARMR system. Now, 20 out of 87 counties may not sound like a lot, but with that level of local participation, easily puts the state of Minnesota in the top five states in the country in terms of local participation. And the reason why we don't have more participation at this point in time is that we have a significant number of studies that are being conducted across the state. 46 counties are currently conducting radio communication studies to assess the radio communication options. We are doing those detailed studies, and part of that study evaluates what they currently have for equipment and then also takes a look at what it would cost to transition onto the ARMR system. So many of our public safety officials are in a holding pattern right now until those studies are done, and we expect those to be completed in the middle part of this year, sometime in the July to September time frame. You may have heard that we recently sold $42 million in bonds to continue the construction of the ARMR system. The bonds have a 15-year term at 4.6%. It's a percent that was better than we expected. We actually had accommodated somewhere in the range of about 5.15, so we were very pleased by that. I can tell you, in the worst market conditions in decades, the reason why that we were able to sell these bonds is that the debt service on these bonds is backed by a dedicated source of funding, and that's the 911 fee. Every single bond house that we talked to asked about, you know, how the funds were backed and the sustainability of the 911 fee, and we're able to show them some independent analysis that we had by a third-party vendor, and that it is a sustainable source of funding, that was something that was very, very important to all the rating agencies and bond houses.
Mr. Wiggins, would you remind us what that fee is and how we do that?
The 911 fee?
Please.
Madam Chair, yes. The 911 fee is collected on each wireless line, wire line, or, your cell phone, or voice over IP line. Okay, and it is 65 cents. In the 2007 legislative session, as part of this ARMR package, the legislature and the governor allowed us to raise that 10 cents a year, spread out over the course of 3 years, to a total of 95 cents. We did have the discretion to raise that to 75 cents in this previous July. We did not do that because when we looked at the actual time frame for the sale of the bonds and when we'd need to make our first debt service payment, it didn't make sense for us to collect money and put it into the account. So we are currently planning a 10-cent fee in July of next year. So for this time frame, for an extra year, it has remained at 65 cents.
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to cover the documents now that I've distributed for you. The front cover here, the first is, of course, a map of Minnesota. The colored regions represent the regional radio boards that I referred to earlier. These regional radio boards are very significant. They are the local control. They are our ability to move on these interoperability issues. The map also indicates a mark where we are planning to put a tower for the ARMR system, and then the various characters, whether they be triangles or squares, indicate where that particular site is at. Some of these sites are still under development. Some of them are on the air. Some of them we have the land, but the tower isn't constructed, etc. The next document that I've provided to you is a organizational chart of our governance structure. At the top is the statutorily created statewide radio board, which also operates as the state interoperability executive committee, which is mandated by the federal government. And then you'll note that the orange boxes are each of our regional radio boards, and under those they're standing committees. The red rectangles on the left are the standing boards of the statewide radio board and the working groups off of those particular standing boards. Lastly, the last document is the interoperability continuum as developed by the federal government. These are all the elements it takes to solve your interoperability challenges. And this is what we are striving to move toward, having all of our, to be on the right side of this continuum and all the different facets. We are currently building a system that is on the right side of this. Our governance structure is on the right side of this. Training and usage, we are doing good with, but we need to do better with. But this is all of the elements that it takes to achieve interoperability. And then finally, Madam Chair and members, I would note this, and that is that the passage of the funding for this legislation back in 2007 is not something that you can put in a 20-word bullet point on a campaign flyer, because this is a very complicated thing. But I can tell you that solving these interoperability challenges is fundamentally changing the way emergency services are delivered to the people of Minnesota, and that is something that you should be very, very proud of. It's something that all the people that are participating in this process, from the local level to the regional level, the state level, keep in mind, and we're all very, very proud of it. And with that, Madam Chair, members, that concludes my testimony this afternoon. I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Wiggins? Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wiggins, just a couple questions, if you don't mind. You said there was 46 counties that are doing the studies, and you mentioned that they are doing a study on other radio communication options. What are those other options?
Mr. Wiggins?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, typically the type of system that is operated in greater Minnesota right now is a conventional VHF system. Those are abundant in almost every single jurisdiction. The FCC has said that everybody who is a two-way radio communication user has to become narrowband compliant. And I'll try not to get too far in the weeds here. But because most jurisdictions, almost all jurisdictions, have not updated their radio communications equipment, it is not upgradable and has to be replaced. So in light of the fact that, again, almost all jurisdictions have to replace their radio communications equipment, these studies look at what would it cost for you to upgrade the system that you have now, which is probably a VHF conventional system. What would it cost for you to do a modern system such as a VHF digital system? And then what would it cost you to migrate to the Armor system? And what are the pros and cons of doing each individual approach or using each approach?
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Wiggins, if some of these counties decide on a different system, isn't that going to basically, you know, scuttle the entire thought pattern of Armor of being on one interoperable system? I mean, how is that going to work if you have some counties? I see here in the southeast corner, there's quite a few there that are up and running, but in the south central and southwest, well, actually all over really, but in the greater Minnesota, what do you do about that if they choose another option?
Mr. Wiggins?
Madam Chair, and just for reference, the map indicates where the Armor network is right now, not who's actually on the system. Mm-hmm. But in the event that counties decide to choose a different alternative, the message that we've delivered to the counties is it is our responsibility to find a way to become interoperable with you. There are different patch devices that allow for interoperable communications, but none of those devices can enhance capacity, and they can't increase coverage. And that's the real benefit that you get by transitioning to the Armor system. So we will create a patch to communicate with you, but if there is a medium or large-scale event in your community, communications will be an issue because we won't have the capacity or maybe even the coverage to communicate.
Madam Chair. The Central and Metro were the first ones to have the system up. How was that funded? Was that paid for? And would that be different than what these other counties are going to have to face as far as funding?
Mr. Wiggins?
Or how is it going to be paid for?
Madam Chair and members, there was in the metropolitan area, there was the 911 fee was increased to pay for a portion of the construction. The cities and counties have made significant investments to enhance the level of coverage for penetrating these big concrete and steel buildings that are in our metropolitan area. There was federal Homeland Security dollars that were used in the metropolitan area. In Phase 3, the 911 fee was increased to build out in Phase 3. As a part of the legislation that was passed in 2005, if counties in Phase 3 wanted to do enhanced coverage, the state did provide some matching grant dollars for that. Those matching grant dollars at this time do not exist for counties in 4, 5, and 6.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, I think Minneapolis put tens of millions, if I remember correctly, into getting this started in Minneapolis.
Am I right? Chair, there's no
Mr.
more
Wiggins?
Homeland Security money.
I should know that, and I guess I don't. Homeland Security money seems to be more available than lots of other money around here. So, Mr. Wiggins?
Madam Chair, Homeland Security money does still flow into the state. As a matter of fact, last year in the interoperable communication section, about $6 million was dedicated to interoperability. Those funds are distributed out through the regional radio boards that I referenced earlier, and they are for specific items. So the regions in Greater Minnesota are receiving federal Homeland Security funds. Sometimes it's for equipment. Sometimes it's for VHF, UHF infrastructure. So some of those federal Homeland Security funds are certainly funneling their way out to Greater Minnesota. And Madam Chair, I don't remember the exact dollar amount for the city of Minneapolis. But if you saw the video that they did after the I-35W bridge collapse, it was one of the items that was noted as a very good expenditure that allowed them to respond to the event.
Exactly. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wiggins, in interest of fairness with funding throughout the state of Minnesota, maybe you can enlighten me how the sales tax has been handled on this. Now, I know the purchase of the equipment in the metro areas. Am I correct in saying that there was no sales tax for that? And if we move further, if we move ahead now, would there be a burden on the rural counties, rural districts, rural sites out here have to pay that same? Or how would we go about being treated the same as far as sales tax? Can you tell me about that?
Mr. Wiggins?
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebretson, you are correct. The metropolitan area and most of Phase 3, they were able to buy not only their infrastructure equipment, if they needed any, and their subscriber equipment, state sales tax free. That sales tax exemption does not exist for any other jurisdictions outside of the metropolitan area and those counties listed for Phase 3. And I do know that that is something that has been widely discussed at the by county commissioners and emergency responders at our regional advisory committees and regional radio boards. I think they're planning some type of letter writing campaign or something this legislative session to try to be afforded that same chance to buy equipment state sales tax free that the other areas of the state were able to get.
Mr. Wiggins, how much of a savings was that? Or how much are we going to have to pay for it to do that?
In order to do it, I think it would, just going from memory here, Madam Chair, I think it's somewhere in the range of about $15 million.
Sounds like a bill for you, Mr. Senator.
Yes, it does, yes. And Madam Chair, I believe the amount for the expenditure that has been done was about $9 million, so 15 sounds about right.
Okay. Okay, good.
Thanks.
Any other questions for Mr. Wiggins? Thank you. I'm sure we'll be talking to you quite a bit in the next 5 months.
Call anytime. Thank you very much.
Let's see. What do we have next? Members, the next several groups who are going to talk to us today are going to talk about the reentry projects that we worked on so hard to get funded. The first one is Mr. Roy up at the Arrowhead Regional Corrections Center, who was doing the Productive Day Initiative. And while he's putting his computer program up, why don't we quickly go around the room
around the table and reintroduce ourselves to the folks who are here in the room today. I'm Senator Linda Higgins from Minneapolis, and I chair this division. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen from District 11. I represent the counties of Todd, Douglas, Grant, and Stevens County in Greater Minnesota.
Senator Foley.
Leo Foley, Senate District 47, which is Champlain, Coon Rapids, and Brooklyn Park.
Senator Limmer.
I'm Warren Limmer from Northwest Hennepin County and about 28 homes in Wright County.
Senator Moy.
Me, Moy, I represent the east side of St. Paul.
Senator Rosen.
I'm Julie Rosen, District 24. I have five counties in south central Minnesota, about 8 miles from the Iowa border. Martin, Faribault, Watonwan, Waseca, and Blue Earth County.
And we also have on the committee Senator Linda Berglund from Minneapolis and Senator Ron Latz from Golden Valley, I think is right.
St. Louis Park.
Senator Latz is the vice chair of the division. And I also want to introduce for all you in the audience who may not have met him yet, my new state representative, Bobby Joe Champion, who's with us today, too. I keep telling him he has a lot to learn, and he may as well come and learn from us as well as all of those meetings in the House that he's going to be doing.
But he's got the wave down already.
He's got the wave down. And Representative Champion, oh, that's a nice name. I don't think I've said that yet. Representative Champion's also an attorney, so he's one up on me on understanding a lot of the things that go on in this division. So, all right, Mr. Roy. Sorry. Welcome. How was the trip down from Duluth?
It's always pleasurable to come here. It's always better to go back.
Okay. All right. Members, you have a packet of information at your place. Go right ahead, sir.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the time to present on this initiative funded 07 for $300,000 2 years. I am cognizant of your agenda. I would like to fly through 16 slides. And give you a feel for what we're doing in the Arrowhead. Cook Lake, Carlton Cooch, St. Louis. St. Louis is 80% of our business. We are a community corrections agency. We provide all correctional services in that region except for prison services. We are population-based, 272,000. Our annual budget, around $22 million. We have three divisions in Arrowhead Regional Corrections, and that relate to this initiative. Our Arrowhead Juvenile Center in Duluth is a maximum security juvenile facility, 24 beds detention. We expanded it about 8 years ago to include 24 beds of treatment. Northeast Regional Corrections Center is our main dispositional facility for young felons in northern Minnesota. It's a minimum security, formerly known as the St. Louis County Work Farm, but since we went community corrections 30 years ago, it is a treatment center. None of the residents that are in that facility spend any time sitting in chairs during the day. Anybody that's in that facility is engaged in either vocational training, education, chemical dependency treatment, sex offender treatment, vocational orientation. We have an active farm operation. We feed our own residents. We give much food to food shelves. It's on a beautiful setting in northern Minnesota, and we'd love to have you tour. We provide court and field services throughout the five counties. We have three courthouses in St. Louis County. We have 7,500 active clients, probation, parole, juvenile, and adult. The challenge that we always face is to reduce recidivism, and the focus of this grant and our use of this grant was on reducing recidivism, and primarily recidivism that occurs shortly after release. And I'll draw your attention to the lower yellow box. We, in 2005, we had 161 young people go through the program at the Era Juvenile Center. 42 of those reoffended within the first 3 months. That time period is very critical, and you're going to be hearing stories, I'm sure, from other programs of similar statistics. Our other challenge always with juveniles is to reduce out-of-home placements, and for I'm sure you have heard testimony from various administrators in the past about the tremendous cost to counties. In 2002 in St. Louis County, we spent over $2.5 million on out-of-home placements. We got that down, you'll see, 2007 at $891,000, and we just got our, we're projecting 2008 to come under $800,000 for the first time in a decade, under $800,000. So we're pretty proud of our work in our juvenile area.
Mr. Roy, excuse me, Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Mr. Roy, if you could turn back the slide to the last one on recidivism. You have 49% recidivism.
Of those that reoffended during that time, 49% did so in that first 3 months.
And then if you add that to the next 3 months, you've got 22%. And then over 6 months, you've got another 29?
Yes, I the arithmetic isn't adding up. If you add up the left column, that will get you to the 86 residents.
You aren't saying that you have 100% recidivism?
No,
there.
Not by any means. Another 22% of those that violated of the 86%, the extra 19.
What is the overall recidivism rate from your institution?
That would be
52%.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Mr. Roy, go ahead.
At the Correction Center, our adult facility, we did a similar analysis, and in 2005, we just completed this study. It's a three-year recidivism study. For those released in 2005, 377, and within 6 months, 59 of those residents reoffended. So we're seeing that that release time immediately after treatment is very critical. Our productive day strategy at AJC and at the Correction Center have been very similar. We hired two caseworkers, one at the Arrowhead Juvenile Center to do specific case management for transitioning back into the community, and we believe it complies with the productive day. And you can see the activities that those caseworkers are doing, which we believe are very important to success and transitioning back into the community. At the Correction Center, we're doing similar intensive casework for those residents that are about to leave. And the one feature that I'd like to point out is that a lot of our residents at our adult facility have child support obligations, and we want to make sure that those obligations and those connections are fully realized when they are released. We have a small operation, and the numbers are very small. Our juvenile operation, our juvenile productive day effort, has focused on 21 clients, and these are the 21 clients that we worked with through 2008. Four of those have failed, and you can see that two committed felonies, one committed a misdemeanor, one committed a petty misdemeanor. In our adult effort, we served 88 clients. Seven of those have since violated, and you can see the type of offenses that they committed. I have to caution you that these recidivism rates are, they look great. And the reason they look great is because they're a very short time period. Main budget expenditures that you're interested in, I'm sure. I'm sorry.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Roy, do you know if those new offenses, in particular the felonies, were they crimes of violence or crimes of property? Because it's very easy to get to the felony level with property damage.
Mr. Roy?
Madam Chair, Senator, I cannot answer that specifically. I have the report in my briefcase. I'd gladly leave it with you. We did a full study.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our main budget expenditures, obviously, for two caseworkers, some support because we have such a large region. In fact, it takes me less time to drive here than it does to International Falls. We're Moose Lake on the south. We're International Falls on the north. So all of our caseworkers and probation officers are very mobile. obviously we need some support, professional services. For 2009, our anticipated expenditures, $75,000 budgeted through June. But in June, we're going to have a balance of $77,000 because we started this grant late. And I will be approaching the Department of Corrections and asking for an extension through 2009. I've talked about the short duration of our recidivism numbers, our low numbers served. Our communities are suffering, and I'm not going to spend time telling you what challenges there are in our communities right now in terms of support for offenders. And our offenders certainly have a myriad of issues, chemical dependency, mental health, employment, et cetera, et cetera. Future locally for us, it's no surprise to anybody that local funding for these types of initiatives is at risk. We are not filling positions. We had a probation officer retire this past week. We aren't filling that position. Our 09 budget, we're down about 7 positions from 08. We're going to be required to prioritize our essential services. We had hopes that the Federal Second Chance Act, which yet remains unfunded, would aid in this transition effort. It remains to be seen what the national scene is going to be for offender reentry efforts. And it should be no surprise to any of us that the healthy economy affects how healthy our citizens are. And in our offender population, if they don't have hope, and if they don't have hope for a job, and I know you're going to hear from some offenders today how important hope is and how important having some positive view of the future is. We work with many people who are hopeless and helpless. And one of the results of that is that they turn to crime and bad behavior. We hope that we can be a force for positive change. And after 35 years in this business, I think we can still make a difference. I think we're getting better at what we do, and I appreciate the time that you've given me this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Clark? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question. Administrating the dollars here and running the business, is there any state mandates or over-regulations that we could address that would help you with your funding? In other words, is there some areas that need to be looked at? I mean, we're going to be looking at anything and everything we can possibly put on the table this year. Any mandates or regulations that you can live with that we could help you with that would help you save some dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, that question has potentially many minutes of answers. And our MACAC organization that I know you are familiar with is preparing the correct answer to that question. And if you can defer to that document, that would be my preference today.
Thank you.
I'm sure we'll be having discussions about that. I think we want to hear about all those things that we can do. Absolutely. Any other questions? Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roy, can you brief the committee members a little bit on what the status is on the Second Chance Act? I know that's not really your area, but I know that you follow it closely because of the reentry work.
Mr. Roy. Madam Chair, Senator, the Second Chance Act is a major initiative that's been in the works for a couple of years, and it has many elements, including developing private sector responses, including funding halfway facilities, vocational. It has 8 to 10 points that are essential, and it has many agencies that are postured to access those funds and start working in this effort. It failed to get funding because of the challenges of the federal government, running wars and such. But we certainly hope with the new administration that the Second Chance Act will be fully funded, and it will give many opportunities for programs like you see sitting around here today.
I'm always fascinated, Senator Moore, about how the federal government enacts the legislation, but the money can come years later.
Well, Madam Chair, in the spirit of economic stimulus from the federal level, and in light of, you know, different conversations that we've all had about how we could perhaps give input to our congressional federal delegation in areas where they could be helpful to us, so that for the kind of investments we want to make here at the state level, we can augment that work by doing it in partnership with our federal government, this might be a good candidate for perhaps a letter from the committee to our congressional delegation.
Members, think about that. We'd be happy to draft that if everybody would like to co-sign. Everybody up for that?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley?
I think that we should wait till we had an opportunity to review the matter with Jordan Leader and some others to see whether there's any directed path. And some is of a greater priority than others.
We'll start on both paths. We'll check with the leader, and we will start getting a letter drafted and figure out who are the contacts in the congressional offices that we need to connect up with. All right. Thank you. Have a safe trip back to Duluth.
Thank you so much again.
And we'll be talking to you soon.
All right, members, and people in the audience, the next demonstration project that we'll be hearing from is the Network for Better Futures. Mr. Steve Thomas and other folks.
Again.
And again, members, the enacting legislation is in your packet, as well as a blue, well, mine's blue anyway. It looks like they're all blue folders from the network. Welcome to our committee. Thanks for coming in today. Who's going to start?
I'll start, Senator. Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Higgins and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to report on the success of the high-risk adult reentry demonstration. My name is Steve Thomas, President and CEO of the Network for Better Futures, the organization that is operating and evaluating the reentry demonstration. And I'm joined at the table today by Daryl Lindsay, our Chief Operating Officer, and two representatives of the network community, Vincent Brinton on my right and Willie Brown on my left over there. I also wanted to recognize that in the audience today we have over 15 men representing the network community, and if they could just stand briefly, please.
Thank you all for coming.
They represent over 120 men who are currently active and enrolled in the network, most of whom are former high-risk offenders released by the Department of Correction over the past year. All these men are working. They're all actively engaged in making a better life for themselves, their families, and our community. Thanks, guys. Senator Higgins, during the 2007 session, you and your colleagues on this committee and in the legislature had the foresight to invest a modest amount of state funds in our bold cost-saving endeavor. And I'm very pleased to report today that we have met or exceeded all the performance expectations that you set for us. Quite simply, we have emerging evidence that the network is a proven means for reducing state funding, creating jobs, and achieving much better results for an expensive group of high-risk consumers of public services. First, and briefly, some background. The network is reducing the economic and social cost of high-risk offenders, primarily African-American men, with histories of incarceration, substance abuse, mental illness, chronic unemployment, and homelessness. This ambitious endeavor was created and is being sponsored by a team of Minnesota's leading healthcare, housing, workforce, community corrections, and human service practitioners. In your handout, their little logos are all on the cover of that sheet. A core feature of our venture is Better Futures. It's our business enterprise, which creates jobs for this high-risk, unemployed group of men. It provides immediate, short-term work for our participants, and it generates earned income for our enterprise. By setting high expectations and providing direct access to the resources these men need to meet these high expectations, namely housing, health insurance, primary health and behavioral health care, short-term employment, and community engagement, men in the network are offered the opportunity to become contributing, productive, and positive members of our community. Our cost-saving innovation responds immediately to an ex-offender's most basic needs: safe, affordable housing, and a job. Let me emphasize this. When a man leaves Faribault, for instance, that afternoon he fills out a lease, He applies for health insurance. He's scheduled for a physical. He fills out employment papers. And if possible, he's working the next day and he has a place to live that night. The core ingredients of the network's approach are also proven means for reducing recidivism and criminal activity. And in the future, if we're fortunate enough to continue to receive funding from the state, we are willing to share some of the financial risk if these results are not achieved. And now Daryl Lindsay will take a few minutes to share some of the performance highlights from our first year, last year, and then I will close out our testimony.
Senator Higgins and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Daryl Lindsay. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the network, and I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon to present some initial data about the performance of our enterprise. We formally launched our endeavor last January, and since then, we have enrolled 221 high-risk men. 85% of these men were enrolled under our contract with the Department of Corrections. 124 of these men are still active with us today for a retention rate of nearly 60%. They are living and working in both Hennepin and Ramsey counties. All of our men are working full or part-time jobs with private employers, or they're working part-time on our Better Futures workforce. About 70% of the men meet the state's definition of long-term homelessness. Nearly all the men have histories of drug addiction, alcohol abuse, and a very high percentage of the men are coping with mental illness or some other type of behavioral health issue. We are working to gather better data about the actual income earned and child support paid, but we do know that our men have earned over $260,000 in wages by working on our Better Futures work crew, and that men employed by other employers outside of the network report that they are collectively earning over $1 million annually. In addition, the men report that they have paid over $80,000 in child support in 2008. We also know that about 50 men were sanctioned for technical violations of their release conditions, but we were able to work with the county agents and restructure the release conditions for 16 of these men. The effect was that 16 men did not go back to prison, and the state avoided of a cost of about $210,000. Through our business enterprise, we have created more than 30 jobs and generated $275,000 in earned income. In addition, we have used the legislature's appropriation of $1.6 million to leverage more than $4.8 million in other sources of private and public investments. And the appropriation has helped us to master lease and provide short-term rent subsidies for nearly 120 apartments. This enables the men to secure the type of quality housing that they are rarely able to access in the open market. Overall, we are enrolling the number and type of high-risk ex-offenders that the legislature and the Department of Corrections expected us to serve, and we have met performance expectations related to retention, employment, and child support payments. We have also connected men to the range of primary health and behavioral health services that are needed to support their transition and success in the community. Finally, we are about to engage researchers from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York to conduct a thorough analysis of our performance and calculate the economic and social benefits of our work, including the amount of savings that we are generating to the state.
Thank you. Thanks, Daryl. Our initial success of the network has been dramatic, and here are some of the key reasons we believe for that success. As I said earlier, we're paid to perform, and our risk-sharing proposal for the future provides a real incentive for us to produce better outcomes. Our approach is built on proven practices. We've been recognized nationally, and we go around, they say, well, you're something like this, and you're something like that, and it's true. We found what works best everywhere in any place, whether it be supportive housing, supportive work crews, but we've brought them together in a way that have never been packaged and delivered. And all these services are proven practices for reducing recidivism without compromising public safety. Our partners' collective track record and power enables us to perform at a high level and meet expectations, and our approach taps into and maximizes the benefit of existing services rather than building an entirely new nonprofit. I'd like to close our remarks by offering some insights and recommendations for how the state can sustain and grow cost-saving endeavors like the network during this period of economic distress. We believe that the current economic crisis, which is viewed by most as the worst since the Great Depression, provides the legislature with a compelling and rare opportunity to be inventive, to reform ineffective practices, and to reduce spending on expensive options like prisons. A range of cost-saving methods are being implemented in other states and counties around the country, and a portion of the savings from these reforms are being invested in community-based reentry alternatives like the network. These reforms promise to achieve much better results for ex-offenders, their families, and our economy without compromising public safety. Specifically, there are two reforms that the legislature should consider and adopt. First, reduce the time served for certain crimes, especially victimless crimes related to drug use and abuse. And second, virtually eliminate the practice of sending offenders back to prison for technical violations of their release conditions. There are a growing number of studies and practices from across the country that demonstrate how these reforms enable jurisdictions to control and reduce spending on prisons without jeopardizing public safety. I've got copies of 5 reports with me today. There's multiple speakers from around the country that we could put you in touch with that are helping at least 8 states around the country do these very reforms. A critical caveat, however, is that these reforms must be coupled with a wise investment in the economic and social supports that an ex-offender needs upon release. When a man arrives from Faribault, he has $100, and basically that's it. And his release conditions are contingent on him finding work, finding housing, a plethora. And it's almost a set for failure. So we've got to have these economic and social supports. Overall, the approach is pretty basic. Control and cut spending on prisons by implementing policies that do not compromise public safety, use a portion of those savings to close the state's budget gap, and then use the remaining portion to support the offender's successful reentry in the community. And we recommend another change in policy and practice that is cost neutral. Use the state's purchasing power to create job opportunities for ex-offenders and social ventures like our Better Futures Enterprises. Even during this fiscal crisis, the state is going to advance construction projects and is going to purchase basic services like building maintenance, recycling, etc. We can achieve multiple economic and social benefits by making employers like Better Futures the first source for low-skill labor needed to complete these projects and provide purchased services. We at the network, which includes, as I said, more than 120 ex-offenders who are committed to transforming their lives after years in prison, are committed to helping the legislature formulate and adopt these cost-saving reforms, and in the same time achieve much better results during this time of fiscal distress. Again, thank you very much for this opportunity and for your support.
Thank you. Mr. Brown or Mr. Britton, can we hear anything from either of you?
Of course.
What kind of work are you doing?
Madam Chairperson, thank you for allowing me to speak.
Would you say your name for the...
My name is William Brown. When we first came in the building, Steve had us stand in the middle of the forum, and he showed us. He just looked around. And he said, "This is one of the best buildings in America." And he also told us, he said, "This is where most of you guys make the rules and regulations that govern our lives." The one thing that I found out is being involved with the network is that they give you a chance to control your own life. Because they put basically everything in your hands. They don't force you to do things. They say, this is on you. Your future is what you make it. You have to do these things. One thing that's most important when you come out of prison is 2 things, housing and a job. Within the first 3 months when you get out, I'm just speaking from a personal thing, from a personal view. The first 3 months you get out of prison, you try to work on these things as much as possible. But you get turned down so much because of the felonies on your record. Nobody wants to rent you. You don't have money for this. You don't have money for that. You can't go stay with your family because most of the time, like myself, you've burned bridges. You can't go stay over mama's house, or you can't go stay over your sister's house. The one thing that I can really appreciate about the enterprise is we didn't have to deal with that. A couple weeks ago, I filled out an employment application. And you know the one thing that wasn't on there? Felonies. Not one mention of it. Not one mention of it at all. I fill out applications. I talk to my team leader. And the one thing I really can appreciate about the network is they care about you. You know, they put everything on you. They're not babysitters. They put everything on you. One thing that I also can appreciate, Senator, is it Limer? Limer. And Senator Latz, you brought up two great, great issues. You talked about the recidivism rate, and you also mentioned whether, when people went back to prison, whether it involved personal or property crimes. Well, you know what? We have such a close, tight knit. I'm talking about these brothers that showed up today. We have such a close, tight knit. That's not even an option for us. Today I went to work, and guess what? My feet hurt, but guess what? I'm going home to my house where I pay rent. See, this might not seem like it means much to you, but it means something to me for somebody coming out of prison, because a lot of us, we're not used to paying bills. We're not used to having a house. We're not used to being responsible. But this is what I learned from the network. You know, you can stand up and stand on your own 2 feet. You don't have to depend on nobody else. You don't have to go somewhere. What they do is they give you the tools and they say, look, this is what you need to do. We're not going to babysit you. Go do this. Do that. We're not going to knock on your door. We're not going to make you do anything. And that's one of the things that we really need. I thought about some of the stuff that I want to say and what I could possibly relate to you to make you guys understand how much we need this funding. But I agreed that I promised myself that I would only speak from the heart. And if it wasn't for the network, I honestly don't know where I would be at. And it works. It works excellent for everybody in this room. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Britton. Mr. Britton.
Madam Senator Higgins, I'm Vincent Britton. I'm honored to be here. And I just want to say that, you know, I just want to comment on two things. The network, the enterprise is something that it's God sent. And I say that because, you know, I didn't know where I would live at, you know, getting out of prison. I didn't want to go live with family. I didn't want to go live with anyone because I felt like, you know, I wanted to be a man. I wanted to be responsible and have those responsibilities as a man. And how could I call myself a man if I'm living on my mother's couch or, you know? And the network gave me the opportunity to be a man, to be responsible as a man. And not only that, I was released from prison in June, and I lost my son, my only child, in July. And I just kind of felt like, and everybody was like, wow, you know, he's going to go back to prison. He's not going to make the right choices. He's going to do something stupid. And I said, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. You know, my son told me when I got out that he was proud of me for getting out of prison. And that meant the world to me. And I said, I'm going to stay out, you know, because I know that's what he would want, and that's what I would want. And the network supported that. They supported me, and they came and got behind me. And this is something that hasn't been mentioned about. I don't know if you guys know, but we have support groups. We have groups Monday, Friday, Saturday, and we have Sunday community dinners Sunday. You know, it's like a family. You know, these guys here is considered family to me. A lot of guys that's been in prison for a long time don't have that. The network is necessary. It's needed because without it, I'm sure that I probably would have committed a crime. I'm sure that some of the other guys probably would have committed a crime. And I don't want to commit any crimes. I want to be a citizen. I don't want to be an offender anymore. And that's what I have.
Thank you both. Where are you working, Mr. Brown?
Where are you? Never for better futures.
And where did you go to work today?
We went. We cleaned two apartment buildings. One was foreclosure. Pardon me.
A foreclosure type property?
No. One of them was a building where to keep youth. It's some kind of youth program for runaways. And they give them a place to live. We go in and we clean the buildings. And we did two buildings today.
All right.
Madam Chair, I am a van driver for the network. I'm responsible for picking the guys up and making sure that they get to work. I'm responsible for picking them up, making sure that they return back to the network and their residence. That's my job. I had a job before that in a warehouse, but sales were slow and they laid me off. But the network, they were there for me. So,
okay, thanks. Questions from the committee? Senator Rosa.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thomas or Mr. Lindsay, is there, to qualify for this program, is there any work or anything done inside the prison before they're released to get them ready? Because obviously you have some very high-quality gentlemen here that have made some life changes and have done a lot of work on themselves, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, I'm sure. Is there a screening process before they're released or after they're released, or how does that work to get them?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I'll let the department answer directly what goes on in the prisons. We have our target prison, and we also recruit from the agents, supervising agents, and halfway houses. But the target prison is Faribault, and I do know they have some discharge planning work going on. We've met with the case managers down there. Oddly enough, we look for the highest risk, whose histories are highest risk. So they, I don't know if you're familiar with the LSI score, which that's a probability to reoffend. So the first criteria is, do you have a medium to high risk to reoffend score? No place to live, a chronic unemployment, a history of mental illness and substance abuse. After that, we don't reject anyone. We do what is called a motivational interview, and these men, the men in the audience can do it. We provide you an offering, and it's basically, here are the deal points. And as long as you're willing to live up to these deal points, you're welcome. And we've had men turn us down, say, I don't want this, or more. Active is, frankly, they think they can kind of game us because they just want the housing, or maybe, you know, or they want a place to crash. And after about a week or two, they kind of say, this is not for me, and they leave.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, Mr. Thomas, Mr. Lindsay, I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about the housing piece, how that fits into the program.
Sure. Madam Chairperson and Senator Moore, the housing piece, we master lease a number of properties both in Hennepin County and in Ramsey County. We've done this because when we initially started, we tried to get these men placed in supportive housing, and no one would take them. So what we've done is master lease a number of properties where we control the entire property, and basically their history, their background is not an issue. If they accept a network offering, they can live in our housing based on our housing guidelines and expectations for them.
And if I may, Madam Chair,
Mr. Thomas?
We subsidize the rent for up to 24 months. So part of our appropriation from the legislature, and this is one of the deal points, so for the first 6 months, your rent's flat at $200. But after that, there's incremental increases. Or if you get a job, we recalibrate your rent to be the market rent.
Madam Chair, and I'm curious about, do you have any issues with the offender registry and the with your population, do you run into kind of reporting requirements or neighborhood notification requirements issues?
Madam Chair, Senator, we're a tenant. And now it's interesting, the first building we master leased in South Minneapolis, the community held a potluck because they were so happy to see us move in because the building had 200 police calls before we moved in. Now if there's a police call, which is rare, we initiate it. So we, for the most part, have been welcomed by the community, and we'll police the block every day for litter. That building better be spotless, and our crews, that's part of their assignment. The work crew's assignment is to clean and maintain the buildings.
Senator Rosen,
thank you, Madam Chair. Are the employment opportunities becoming easier? I mean, are employers opening up to this idea, or do you pretty much have a set number of employers that you keep going back to?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Thomas?
Senator Rosen, we have five superstar employers who have just been great. One, our biggest, is called DEMCON. They run a landfill down in Shakopee. They hire 10 men regularly to come down and sort construction waste. Midwest Asphalt, now they're dormant now, but we wash their equipment. Willie mentioned we have a property management company, Aon Management, which hires us to do 12 of their properties, and then Eureka Recycling. That's our core, and we're looking to grow. It's interesting. We thought we would do more kind of piecework, but we've landed these employers who are very I mean, they don't tolerate poor performance, nor do we, but they've been very welcoming of our unique service.
Mr. Thomas, remind us, you said you get paid for performance, and I was just looking at the language, and would you give us a quick reminder of how we do pay?
Yes. Madam Chair, this is something we worked out with the department, and what basically there's a we receive a flat rate, and as long as we are enrolling eligible men who meet the requirements outlined in the department contract, we get paid. If the man leaves or is no longer performing at the level that we expect, we don't get paid. What I've said earlier, for this upcoming biennium, if we're fortunate enough to continue and expand this, we are willing to lower our fee by 25%. The fee is only paid to us for a maximum of 24 months. And when I said risk sharing, we are willing to have the state withhold 5% of our fee. And if any time during the year the man is rearrested, goes back to prison, isn't paying child support, or is unemployed for 21 straight days, we lose that 5%. That's what we're proposing for the – so lowering our fee 25% in the upcoming year and share some of the financial risk for success.
Senator Watt?
You know, Madam Chair, I was just reflecting as I was listening to our two team members speak that the things that they talk about is not too different from the experiences of a lot of my refugee relatives who come to this country. And, in fact, when my mom and dad got off the airplane at the airport, they had no driver's license, no Social Security card, no place to live, no job, and not even $100 in their pocket. And so I think that it's really great. It's really this program is really great, and I'm glad to hear that there's some good things happening.
Thank you.
I know that we'll be talking to you again in the next 5 months as we're trying to put the budget together. Thank you all for coming today. And if you have ideas, I wrote down several of the ideas that you had. And the reports that you talked about, if we could have copies of those, and we'll
certainly
get them to the members so we can all be brought up to date on the information that you've gathered for us.
Great. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. The next group we'll hear from are the Emerge Community Development folks. Emerge's office is a block from my house, so I went up and visited just the other day. So if Mr. Nguyen and Mr. Clark, and I don't know if anybody else is here with you, come on up to the table.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity to be here today. My name is Mike Nguyen. I'm the Executive Director of Emerge Community Development, which is a nonprofit based a block away from Senator Higgins' home on Emerson Avenue and West Broadway in North Minneapolis. And we are focused on workforce development and community wealth creation. First, I want to thank the committee for its leadership in bringing a focus and energy to the topic of reentry services and its visionary support of these programs that are being piloted right now in the community. I also want to thank our partners in this hearing room today and appreciate their growing efforts like the ones at the network that we heard before us, and acknowledge our staff, many of whom are here, and I would ask them to stand up. And the staff, please. The people who do this important work every day. Our organization, Emerge, is while we have a long history of working with ex-offenders, we launched our first specific project with a specific employment project with ex-offenders in 2004. And since that time, We've built a lot of momentum with a continuum of employment resource projects, which includes our StreetWorks project, which is a fee-for-service maintenance enterprise, which employs adult ex-offenders to work in transitional employment. That works in conjunction with the continuum strategy of targeted job services, including pre-employment, direct placement into the labor force, placement in temp to perm jobs through our own on-site staffing service, Emerge Staffing, and job retention coaching and a whole host of other case management and supportive services intervention programs. We started this pilot beginning in October of 2007, and the pilot has enabled us to further target our resources to state offenders returning to North Minneapolis, the project we call Northside Reentry Connections. You have a report in front of you, I believe, and the project has allowed us to provide a more intensive set of interventions, and we have some summary reports on our work over the first 15 months of that project, which I would like to highlight for you here. So far in 15 months, we've engaged 212 DOC offenders, and of those to date, 69 have secured regular jobs, an initial average wage of $9.13 per hour. 23 of those have advanced to higher wages during their time with us by an average increase of $1.12 per hour. To date, over 70% of those participants have retained their jobs beyond 90 days, and nearly 60% have retained beyond their 365-day interval. This state support has significantly helped us leverage other smaller funding we receive from the city, Hennepin County Area Foundations, and United Way of the Twin Cities to create a larger effort that has served during the same period 446 felony ex-offenders, securing 131 jobs and a comprehensive range of other services. These offenders have been placed at a total of 83 different employers in our community. What we've learned is, and through this engagement, we found that participants who engage more deeply with our job counselors, they remain employed longer, they're more likely to obtain and retain their job, and they're more likely to stay employed than people who are not as deeply engaged in job counselor. At Emerge, we know that it's not enough to attempt to improve an individual's human capital. It's also important to address changes in motivation and lifestyle away from criminal activity to a positive engagement. And this takes time. It's more complicated than teaching marketable skills, and it may mean reestablishing connections to organizations in the broader community, and we work with many partners to do that along the way. We feel there are a number of significant outcomes, and we believe what we're demonstrating is that ex-offenders can get jobs, and even in this tough economy, based on our early findings, we're finding a strong connection between this employment attachment and reduce recidivism, especially a reduction in reoffenses. And we would echo the recommendations made about technical violations and, if possible, removing them altogether, as this we see is often a real detracting factor in bringing people back into the system where we might be able to prevent that. We believe the program is now only really getting footing and extremely well poised to offer an important community outlet for many years to come. Our organization and team have become a key go-to employment and training program for ex-offenders, not just in North Minneapolis, but throughout our area, throughout our region, actually. And we take on that challenge very seriously. Working with felony ex-offenders in a job search is extremely challenging work. It takes nearly a doubling of efforts in employment programs to overcome stigma challenges, the discouragement, skill gaps, and personal and individual challenges. But we know this is an extremely wise investment for our state to make, and it's producing a significant return on investment. At this time, I'd like to now turn it over to my colleague, Marvin Clark, who's the program manager of Northside Reentry Connections, and tell you a bit more about our project. And I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. What I would like to do, Madam, is to just explain a little bit about our program and what set us aside from most employment service agency. We are not just an employment service agency. We do a lot of hand-holding there. Therefore, we don't just give people leads or give the offenders leads to go to a job. First of all, we want to start by empowering the individuals by giving them a hand up versus a hand out. We want to empower them to make them feel empowered and to take them, if necessary, to these different jobs, to take out the frustration of having doors closed in their face by contacting potential employers before the individuals are sent out to find out what is their employment need, to do some advocating on their behalf, not only with the potential employers, but with their POs, with their halfway houses, or with anyone that's concerned and their needs and to empower them. Because, you know, in this society, we can get people jobs all day. But if a person is not satisfied with that job, they're not going to retain that job. Our bottom line is retention. If we get someone who can retain their jobs, they were more likely to stay out of prison and without reoffend. If an individual is happy about the work they're doing or satisfied with the work they're doing, they're willing to get up on time, to be to work on time, to stay longer hours if necessary. At the moment, our partners are people like the network, people like the MCorp pilot project, other community-based organization, Goodwill, Easter Seal, and I can go on and on. But that's where we're at, and that's what set us apart from other employment service agency, is to just collaborate, knowing that we're not all things to all people, but we can do what we do well to empower, to get them ready in the work readiness aspect. We have several job clubs, work readiness programs that we offer to our participants. We want to make sure that their resumes to put together, their cover letters together, and then that their interviewing skills is together, as well as their dress, their appearance. Because the first appearance, we all know, the first appearance is what's going to get them in the door. And if that's not right, then it's not going to work. So we're about empowering and about taking them by the hand if necessary and taking them. I have my staff to put them in your car, take them to the interview, coach them on the way as well.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Yes.
Questions? Emerge. Mr. Clark, the other day you were telling me about some of the folks going through revocation. Tell us a little about the kinds of things that people will get revoked back to prison for.
People get revoked back to prison, and we're talking on technical violation for unaccountability, for usage of chemical, whether it's alcohol or drugs. Basically, those are the three main items that people get violated for, is that unaccountability or usage of unauthorized drugs, mood-altering drugs. Is basically what it is. And in our effort and what our advocating for, we tries to advocate with the PO for when they're getting sent back, not to send them back, but allow us to advocate to get them into treatment, because I have connection with the CD community that I can get a person into treatment right away. If it's mental health, then we have connection in the mental health community, you know. But those are technically what it is. It's just technical violation. That issue really needs to be addressed in this state, is the technical violation. Too many people was being sent back. There's people that have jobs, and if they get violated and they get sent back, then there's a double hardship there, because now the state or the taxpayer within the state has to pay that money to house when he was working, then he was a producer versus being a consumer.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Wynn, you said you started when did you actually get this program off the ground?
The launch date was October of 2007, so we're 15 months into the project.
15 months in. So are we going to need to extend the period of time for you to use what would have ordinarily been a two-year?
Madam Chair, our contract was, we worked with the staff, and the contract was established for a 21-month period. So
21
it will,
months.
It will conclude at 21 months.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Thank you both. Thanks to everybody from the staff who came today. And we will be talking to you again in the near future, I'm sure.
Thank you.
The M-Corp project is the next item we'll hear about. I think Mr. Johnson's going to start.
Mm-hmm. Chair?
Welcome back, everyone. Whenever anybody's ready, go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, we too want to thank you for this opportunity to present to you today on what kind of improvements and updates we can give you about the MCOR pilot project and the MCOR Strategic Reentry Initiative itself. I'll draw your attention to mine is gray, but you have red folders in front of you with information about MCOR. My part of the presentation today will be to give you a brief summary of what MCOR is about and also to give you a little outline of some very preliminary statistics that we have about the MCOR pilot project. And then my three partners here today from the pilot counties will be telling you about what's going on individually in each of their counties with the MCOR grant. If you take a look at the Department of Corrections backgrounder on the MCOR pilot project, I just want to go through a couple of things here. We updated this recently, and it gives you a quick idea of what MCOR is all about. It's really a multi-agency collaboration between state agencies that have business with the offenders that we have in our facilities. So you'll see on the front of the page a list of some of those state agencies that are involved with the MCOR initiative and our partners on our steering committee. They include the Department of Human Services, Department of Employment and Economic Development, Department of Public Safety, and other agencies here that you can take a look at yourself. I want to give you just a quick overview about some of the collaborations that have come out of the business that our steering committee has put together and some of the work that our own department reentry services unit has done. So I'll draw your attention to the center column of the back page of this document that gives you a listing of some of the collaborations that we have done. And there are quite a few in number over the last 18 months. First item there is a collaboration that we have done with the Department of Human Services, Child Support Division, where we have funded jointly a child support liaison position, a person who is housed at St. Cloud State Reformatory. She does investigations into new admissions at that facility and at our Shakopee facility for women to determine if offenders have child support, arrearages, what that amount is. She does counseling with those offenders who have child support arrearages and gives them some assistance in developing a way of paying for their child support. And she also links to county child support agencies, something that we at the department have not done in the past. And it's been, I think, very cost-effective for those local counties to know where their child support cases are when they get into the Department of Corrections system. A second collaboration we have is an interagency agreement with the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Vehicle Services specifically, where we have collaborated with them to have driver's license and state ID document equipment brought to our facilities so that offenders who are in their transition period can get state IDs or driver's licenses if they if that's the appropriate thing for them to do, so that they have ID documentation when they leave our facilities. We also have an interagency agreement with the Department of Employment and Economic Development where we are implementing a dead-end, very secure website where we bring the MinnesotaWorks.net website to our facilities. This is the first for us. We're probably 2 or 3 weeks away from being able to implement this at our facilities, so that offenders who are transitioning, they're near their release date, can actually go on the website and look for employment before their release. Another interagency agreement that we have with DEED includes a pilot project that's being done at a couple of workforce centers in the metro area where workshops are being held for reentering offenders that give them some information about how to use the services at a workforce center. They actually get a certificate of completion of that workshop. And we have just some preliminary data from October and November when workshops were held, where 19 participants, offenders who went through this workshop, got certificates. And of that 19, six of them got jobs that were paying $12 an hour or better. So this is a vast improvement from some of the performance data we've seen with workforce centers related to offenders' use of those services. We also have an interagency agreement with the State Public Defender's Office for a reentry legal services clinic, a clinic for law students at William Mitchell College of Law, where the Department of Corrections, through our reentry money, our profits from our MinCor industries, is devoted towards paying for a position for a state public defender to direct that law student clinic. And those law students are working with female offenders at our Shakopee facility at about the point that they're going through their transition program at Shakopee, where they give them legal mentoring around civil legal issues, such as divorce, name change, child custody issues, parenting time issues. And this has been a very, very interesting project. And we have just seen some terrific interest in this on the part of law students at William Mitchell. And I have some very high hopes for this particular project. So that's just a list of some of the things that are going on with MCOR and our interagency arrangement with other state agencies. The other thing that I'm going to do today here before I introduce the other partners from our pilot project is to go over a document that we have in your folder. It's called Preliminary Results for MCOR Post-Release Data. We have collected information through our pilot project agents who are working in our three pilot counties on 149 offenders so far who have gone through phase one of our reentry pilot project. You can see some various categories of data that we are collecting. This is a very basic document. I want to make that point fairly clear that We're not staking claim to this being an absolute research document that you could count on, because the information is very, very early and preliminary in our pilot project. But what we wanted to do was to bring this to let you see firsthand that we have a research component to what we're doing with MCOR, and we are going to collect that data. We're going to put some rigorous work into determining what works and what doesn't work with our pilot project, and hopefully this kind of data will show us exactly where we need to go with our reentry initiative. And if you have any questions about that, I'd be happy to entertain those, just keeping in mind that really this document doesn't tell you a whole lot yet. So at that point, I'd like to introduce the other members of our pilot project. To my immediate right is Wanda Berg, the program manager from Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted County. Next to her is Andy Erickson, the deputy director of Ramsey County Community Corrections. And on my far right is Dennis Avery, the reentry coordinator for Hennepin County Community Corrections and Rehabilitation. So I'm going to ask that each of them give you just some background and update as to what's been going on in their counties with our MCOR grants that we funded their programs with. And I'll start with Wanda to my right.
Welcome, Ms. Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I have to tell you, just the other day, somebody from Rochester was saying to me, you know, we need a reentry program down where we are. You don't think we have one, at least the start of one.
Yes, we do. Okay. Yes, we do. Thank you again for allowing me to be here today and to present on what we've used our the grant that we were given through the Department of Corrections to do reentry programming in Rochester. I think one of the biggest things is that we are finally able to have case planning occur in the prison before the offender gets ready to transition out to the community. So I have a specific agent who works with those MNCOR participants, so he's actually doing inreach into the prison to meet with people before they get out so that case plans that are developed in the prison can follow them out into the community and be consistent so that the resources that we have, they already know about it and we can use for somebody to do that. So that has been a huge highlight because we did not have that before. One of the big barriers, of course, has been housing. For 30 months, I dealt with a local ordinance that kept me from having transitional housing. By managing to negotiate and work with the Department of Corrections, we've now been able to open an 8-bed transitional living center for offenders coming out that are homeless. And I'm averaging, I had 300 prison releasees in 2008, and I was averaging about 37% homeless. So people were being released from prison and coming out homeless and coming to my agent's office, and we needed to find a place to go. I had lost the two big places that would rent to our clients. One of them is now a parking lot. The other one is no longer taking felons. So we had a real homeless problem. When people were homeless, it also made it very difficult for them to get employed because there wasn't an address where employers could find them. So what we found was when you made somebody unemployable, homeless, and hopeless, recidivism was going to occur because they went back to what they knew. So by having the transitional housing center, we can house up to 8 clients at a time. They are supervised for a good portion of the day. But that was through our collaboration and part of our negotiation to use some of our grant to do that. We've also contracted with a local employment specialist who specializes in helping ex-offenders to explain their incarceration time and those gaps in their resumes. And she's come up with some creative ways to help them explain because we're using their work time in the facilities as a part of them having work experience. So that's been huge. She also teaches a class on soft skills, interviewing skills, employment leads, and working with employers on hiring felons. She will help them do the bonding program and the tax breaks that people can get through the federal government. We have financial assistance for our clients to enter into the Manufacturing Academy, which is a 3-week program, 40 hours a week. When people finish that, they earn 8 certificates, including forklift operator, OSHA compliance, and the others escape me, but they leave with that. So employment for them has become much easier. We also have a starting over program that's been operating for over a year. It's a 16-week program where we bring the resources to the clients, so they have things like education, child support and parenting, employment, chemical health, housing, and healthy relationships. We've had 5 people who have enrolled in college and gotten scholarships to be there. We've had 4 people complete their GEDs, and the child support office tells us that they're having much better luck with at least having people attempting to make payments on their child support, even if they're not paying the whole amount. They're making some sort of payment and staying in touch with their child support worker. And we also have implemented a coming home program, and that's for the families, significant others, spouses, and friends of offenders coming out that occurs before the offender comes out so that they can understand what supervision is going to be like coming out. This is facilitated by a therapist and probation officer. They discuss conditions of release, having someone reenter the family, the changing in roles, and those difficulties. And this has been so positive, the participants have asked us to extend the time on it and to do follow-up meetings because it's been so helpful for them. So those are some of the things that we've used our money for in Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted County to try to help people reenter successfully.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Berg?
We want to move on to Dennis Avery.
Oh, all right. We'll take questions at the end then. All right.
Okay.
Mr. Avery?
Thank you, Senator Higgins and committee members. Dennis Avery with Hennepin County. Let me start out by just kind of describing the structure of M-Corp in Hennepin County. We have 3 agents assigned to the M-Corp initiative in Hennepin County. These agents carry an average caseload of about 30 to 1, and we've served a total of 103 clients so far. Even though this money was appropriated and made available, you know, on the fiscal year, the county operates on a calendar year, and by the time we got everybody hired and backfilled and the program in place, it was pretty much January of 2008 before we really started taking a large number of referrals from the prison. The 3 agents' office together, we have chosen in Hennepin County to provide a lot of the services to these offenders via contract. So we spent a good deal of our time at the front end identifying what some of the major resources are that clients needed to be successful. And so we have a contract with Amicus for issuing bus passes for clients so that they can go out and look for employment. And once they secure employment, to be able to, until they get a car or get on their feet and have their own means of transportation, that we can help to subsidize that bus fare. We also contracted with an individual for an African-American men's support group using a cognitive restructuring intervention format. We also have contracted with St. Stephen's for housing assistance because they really are the housing experts, or one of the housing experts in the metropolitan area. We drew a separate contract for family unification because we understand that in many instances, offenders who have been away in prison for a long time who want to reunite with their significant other or wife and kids, we have to remember that while they've been gone, mom has been in place taking care of the family. She's been the rule setter, the rule enforcer, and has run the household. And so when usually the male, because most of the folks we work with are men, although we do also serve women coming out of Shakopee Prison, that they need to deal with some of those issues in order to better make that adjustment. We also have a small mentoring contract, and we are working right now on an employment readiness contract with Goodwill Easter Seals. One of the things that I think has been most useful to us in Hennepin County has been a really fully engaged M-Corp advisory group. And Senator Higgins, you were kind enough to attend one of our meetings. And that group meets on a regular basis. And we've got representation in that group from the faith community, we've got treatment expertise, housing specialists, job resource people, and private sector representation in that group. And they've been extremely helpful to us in guiding the direction and work of this M-Corp initiative in Hennepin County. One of the most significant things that MCORP has done that's been different is this mutual case planning and assessment process. Because of the size of our caseload, if you're looking at a regular SR caseload in Hennepin County, you're probably looking at 65 to 70 people on the streets, and it has been higher than that. It came down slightly because we have now three MCORP agents that are also taking referrals. But it was just not possible and is not possible for those agents to go into the institution and visit all their clients before release. But we virtually go in and visit all of our clients prior to release in the institution. And we sit down with the client and the caseworker, review the LSI assessment score. We look at the identified needs. We work on what's called a SMART plan, which is really a reentry plan that earmarks those things that an offender has identified for himself or herself, along with the professional staff, with regard to what they need to do to be successful out in the community. One of the other things that I think is important that I want to kind of highlight here with regard to MCORP, with all due deference to the other reentry programs that you've heard from today and will hear from, those programs do have the opportunity to go to clients and solicit their involvement in the program. So, in other words, those programs are able to say, would you like to be part of us? Would you like to go with our program? Would you like to be a participant? And I think once you have that commitment and once you have that kind of volunteerism on the part of the offender, I think you kind of cleared your first hurdle because you've got somebody who wants to work with you. And one thing that was intentionally set up with the MCORP research design is to have a control and a study group, but you don't have a choice of whether you come into MCORP or not. And I think that's significant because most of the people coming out of prison don't have a choice about where they go. They're going to go into intensive supervised release, regular supervised release, or MCORP. I just want to read you briefly a memo that was sent to a caseworker from one of the offenders who ended up in MCORP. He says, Mr. Clark, I'm going to tell you, like I told my other two caseworkers, I don't want to do MCORP. I'm not interested in MCORP, and I'm not going to do it. I haven't signed anything saying that I wanted to do MCORP, so could you please not bring it up anymore? Thank you. Well, in the end, the agent went up and visited this individual in prison and spent 2 hours with him in a room. And by the time she was done, he was ready to come out to MCORP. So I think our agents are not only there to provide a support and service to people and hold them accountable, but they're really there to kind of sell them on a belief that you can make changes in your life if you give yourself the opportunity. And this particular individual has been out now, has had no problems. He attends the African-American CAG group that I mentioned. He's active with Goodwill Easter Seals. He's 30 years old. He's never had a job in his life. And his mother told the agent, I'm taking his first check and I'm going to frame it and put it on the wall in the kitchen. He's not going to let her do that. He's going to go out and cash it, I'm sure. In spite of this involuntary participation on the part of the offenders, right now, for the first 12 months of 2008, Hennepin County MCORP has experienced a return to prison rate of 13.6%. 103 offenders. Now, to put this in some kind of context, the national prison recidivism rate is 67.5%. And the Minnesota rate is approximately 36%. I think it's something like 52% for ISR, 28% for non-ISR clients. That's intensive supervised release where we have our level 3 sex offenders. So, on that note, what I guess I'd finally like to do is just invite you, as some of the other presenters have, to look at what would happen if we took this model to scale. In other words, if we can show, and as Gary mentioned, these figures are preliminary, but if we could show consistently that we have a return to prison rate somewhere in the neighborhood of 15%, and we took that to scale, we normally have a return to prison rate in Minnesota, around 35 to 40%. Could that savings prevent the state from having to expand current prison capacity beyond what it is now and potentially back away from some of the leased bed space that the state participates in with contract vendors? So that's just a policy question that I'd like the committee to at some point consider. And I'll end my comments there. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Erickson.
I knew I would be last, and I knew that I would get 2 minutes, so I was told to use pictures. My name is Andy Erickson. I'm Deputy Director responsible for adult probation in Ramsey County in St. Paul. I do have some overheads. They are on 4 per page. There's only a total of 4, so it is a short presentation in your folder. So you've heard a lot of numbers, heard a lot of some stories, and I thought it might be helpful to visually characterize what are we talking about, what's the essence of the problem, and what are we trying to accomplish through MCORP. In Ramsey County, we have used the MCORP dollars to hire 2 agents, experienced agents, get them properly trained, and have small caseloads. In Ramsey County, they have 30 per agent. Regular supervised release, those just out of prison in Ramsey County, there's 90 is the average right now. So not the best, but I'd like to show you what we think that has accomplished. When you get out of prison, it's often said that its prison is somewhat of a revolving door. In fact, I've heard that as many as 40% of each year's prison admits are because of revocations from people who've gotten out but are now being sent back. And a lot of those are not new crimes. They're technical and other kinds of violations. So if you're getting out of prison and you can see all the various roadblocks that offenders face, from unfamiliarity with complex systems, you're on medications for psychiatric conditions, and then you get out of prison and you don't have a way to continue those psych meds, so you stop taking them or you spread them out. There are relapse issues. There's the felony record, which we've already heard about. There's less and less community resources. I'm not exactly proud to say that in Ramsey County, our purchase of service budget in the corrections department in the adult area is 1/4 the size of what it was 5 years ago. I mean, they're just the stuff we used to, let's put them here for a while. Let's put them in a halfway house. It's just gone. We just don't have that anymore. So let's see if this works to go to the next page. There we go. Now, this is a little blurry, but I actually counted. There's 30 little people on this one side, and there's 90 little people on this other side. But how does MCORP try to stop that revolving door from that first slide? First, let's look at traditional supervised release. These are folks that have served most of their sentences in prison. They're being released into the community with the rest of their sentence kind of hanging over their heads. Okay? Do they stay out and start to build a life, or do they spend the rest of their time in prison? So traditional supervised release. With 90 to 1, it's very difficult to spend much time developing a relationship with the offender, between the agent and the offender. You're more likely to give them lists. Here's a list of houses. Here's a list of places to get a psych evaluation. Here's a place where you might get in because you're still having struggles with chemical dependency, where you might still work, or you might get a place to live. And it's really, from a public safety standpoint, it's really difficult to, well, it's impossible, really, to supervise these people who've just been released from prison adequately when you've got one agent working with 90 offenders. I think that averages about an hour, 0.3 per month per offender that you can spend on their case. Now, MCORP, which is the left column, and what we've been doing in, I believe, all 3 of the counties, you have the time for case consultation with other professionals, someone from human services, maybe someone from public health, talk about what can we do here with this guy, here are his issues. Relationships and trust develop between the agent and the offender. And then the agent's more likely to explore different options for treatment and different options for housing and employment with the offender. When there's a relapse or a dirty urinalysis test, it's really tempting when you've got 90 offenders on your caseload to say, let's recommend you go back to prison. Much less likely if you have time to spend and say, you know, it was a relapse, let's keep working with it, and so on. Our agents have been extensively trained in how to be effective with the reentry population, plus we have some other ancillary resources, bus passes, damage deposit, those kinds of things that we've been working with our offenders. Now, this is a research thing, and I should have footnoted it, and I haven't, and I can get it if people. But the research shows that why do offenders change? 3 leading reasons. About 1/3 of the reason is offender initiative, 30%. offender initiative, their own doing, their own initiative, their own finding whatever, and they've just made a decision that they're going to change. About 10% of it is some sort of program they went through. Could be chemical dependency, employment, it could be cognitive skills, but it was that intervention. Another 30% is the relationship with the probation officer. And so when some say, well, you want smaller caseloads, quit your whining, we're short of resources, just get it done, who cares if you know them well? Well, the relationship does matter in terms of recidivism, and the relationship does matter in terms of helping this offender be successful and not get back in that turnstile and go right back into prison. So I would like to make the case at the bottom there, that pie chart. Oh, good, it's still on there. That smart supervision is engaging in effective supervision and relationship building with the offender in order to prevent the next criminal act. And that's why we want the relationship. That's why we want to do effective supervision. It's not about liking them, getting along, creating more friends for your Facebook profile or whatever. It's about preventing the next criminal act. Then finally, the Ramsey County experience. This is a typical caseload. If the caseload goes all the way up, I call it the y-axis, about two-thirds in this first area, two-thirds of our offenders coming out of prison have some type of chemical dependency issue. With our two caseloads of M-Corp, about half of them have used at least once since they've been out. At least it could be alcohol, could be whatever, but there's been some chemical use. 30% have, when they've been released, have some type of diagnosed medical disorder, mental health disorder. Now, our typical revocations, which is this one-third, in our supervised release caseloads, we have about, if you include intensive supervised release and regular supervised release, we have about 20 agents doing this kind of work. But the typical revocation rate is about a third. So for every agent who's got 90, about 30 of them he's sending back to prison or she's sending back to prison. Now, what we've experienced in our first year with M-Corp, with the smaller caseloads, we've returned in each case, three offenders on another caseload. So that relationship, that visually kind of describes what we're doing and why and what we think it's done. And I'm way past my 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Questions for the M-Corp folks? Senator Rose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to Mrs. Burke about, do you have a mental health program in your program? I mean, are you working on mental health? I didn't hear you say anything about that. And is that something that is getting a lot more attention now? And how are you addressing that issue? Because it's obviously part of the entire chemical dependency issue.
It is, and we have several specific programs. We have a pilot program for the amphetamine addictions and et cetera that it ties into the mental health. So if we have an offender who's had any type of chemical dependency in the past, they are qualified then through that grant to get a mental health assessment. So we're working with our local mental health center down there as well as several other mental health therapists to work with people on those mental health issues. Our Salvation Army there, along with Mayo Clinic, has a clinic that people can drop into to see a mental health professional and then get their medications through that as well. So we have included that component that's kind of across the board, though not just specifically with the M-Corp.
Other questions? Thank you all. I know we'll be talking to you folks as we go forward in this legislative session.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we have about a half hour left of our committee time, and we have two more projects that we wanted to hear from. The next one is Dr. Oliver Williams for the Offender Reentry Domestic Violence project that we worked with, and then we'll end up with the Mentoring Children of Prisoners being done by the Big Brothers and Big Sisters. So, Professor Williams.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be here as well. And thank you for the support you've given us in terms of trying to pull something together where I call it building a bridge. You know, what we've been trying to do with this project is to address the issue of domestic violence and prisoner reentry. The reality is, as we've heard, the issues that have been discussed that I'm in total agreement with in terms of the challenges that men have in terms of returning back to the community in terms of employment and housing and substance abuse issues and being, getting a chance to have a hand up. I agree with all those things, but one of the challenges that we've noticed in our work is that one of the things that can also assist in successful reentry back to the community and perhaps back to families is addressing the issue of domestic violence. The Institute, as I've mentioned to you before, when I had a chance to talk to you in the past, has been involved in doing a project with the Department of Justice Office on Violence Against Women, which is called the Safe Return Initiative. And one of the things that we've learned in that process is that oftentimes men may end up getting their parole revoked and sent back to prison because of charges related to domestic violence. We also have known in the different prison programs that we work with that sometimes they've developed domestic violence programs to deal with the men that have been coming back and have been revoked because of domestic violence. So let's talk to you a little bit about what we've tried to do in this project and all the pieces that are we've tried to put together. We have partnerships, and much of our grant is contracted out to different service providers in the state of Minnesota. In particular, Domestic Abuse Project, which has a history of providing domestic violence services. Our primary organization that we're working with is Lionel Lakes. And we're getting level one work releases to come through their project to another collaborative partner called My Home, Inc., that's working with the project there in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Domestic Abuse Project is working with the men as they're beginning to transition into the community. So they're at Lionel Lakes, and we're attempting to get them to educate men in their transition back to the community, classes that they have to take in terms of dealing with the challenges of returning back home, and to talk specifically around the issues of family violence. With My Home, Inc., what they do is they provide services for men that are reentering the community and are in halfway houses. And they provide a lot of education and support services for the men in terms of trying to find housing and education on different levels. But one of the things that they have been doing and that what we've tried to do is enrich what they've been doing around the issues of family violence and working with the men, having conversations about dealing with the issues related to domestic violence. So what we've tried to do and what we've brought from the Safe Return Initiative is information related to the issues that women in relationships with men in prison on parole and what men who've been in prison on parole say are challenges that result in domestic violence. Those things have not been included in traditional domestic violence projects, in programs and batterers intervention curriculums. Those things have not been included in what traditionally gets included in even My Home's program. So what we've done is enriched what they've done as well. But what we've also done is worked with another program called Oasis of Love. And Oasis of Love is a project that's in Minneapolis. And what they do is they provide services for a range of women and men in the community. They have histories of working with people who are reentering. But what's specific about this project and what's important and that what we need to attend to related to this issue is the fact that oftentimes when we've had conversations about men reentering the community, one of the things that we haven't had real conversations about as much is what happens with their partners or the mothers of their children. So if what you're talking about is helping people to reunify or make connections with family, or the mothers of their children, and domestic violence may have been an issue. And we found in the different studies that it has been an issue for a lot of men coming back to the community. What we want to do is to sort of go upstream and help connect their partners to programs and services and referrals to programs where they can either be provide safety, have discussions about their concerns and fears about them coming home, get connected to not only shelter programs, but also have the capacity to be able to problem solve to address their needs. Another project that we're working with is Family Services in Minneapolis. So when men are off level one work release and back into the community, they can carry on with an ongoing sort of aftercare effort to for men that choose to continue on in terms of trying to find some support on the issues of their interactions and behaviors around violence and family integration. But another thing that we're developing is called the DVPSQ, and that's the Domestic Violence Problem Solving Questionnaire. And this instrument is something that's real important. There have been other instruments that have been developed called SARA, and there's another domestic violence inventory that has been developed that people in some communities use. Some of them don't routinely use it. But it's very labor-intensive. And the ability to be able to gather the consistent information about the backgrounds of the people that are reentering the community takes a lot of effort, but you don't consistently get all the information to help you make the best assessment about what the potential outcomes will be. What we're trying to do is to develop something that in the order of an MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, that is a norm instrument that you can actually give to someone, and based on how they respond to these set of questions, without getting a lot of background on each one of the persons, you'll be able to predict who's at high risk and who's at low risk for recidivating back to around domestic violence issues. So we're in process of trying to pull that together and to create this instrument. We're in phase two of the development of the instrument, and it will be something that's quite unique, but we're proud of our process of being able to do that. So we think that's also a benefit to what we're trying to do. Basically, the concept behind it is that we try to figure out what the normal way to approach problem-solving circumstances for men that are coming back into the community from prison. But then what we also try to do is to identify people who end up having sustained, controlling, manipulative, abusive behaviors. And then by that, there may be more intensive activities that one might be able to use to be able to intervene and to deal with those folks. Any questions at this point?
Thank you very much. I'm monitoring the clock. And
yeah.
If we can just stop at that point, would that be okay? And we'll
That's fine. I've got other things to say if you want to hear them, but I can take questions if you...
All right. Questions for Professor
I do, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Williams, right? Problem-solving questionnaire. Are you the first one in the nation to develop a questionnaire like that?
Yes.
We'll be sharing it, I would hope, with others.
Absolutely, yeah. And there are other models that are developed, but this one is going to be quite unique and different from the other ones that folks have been using in the past.
It's very exciting. Other question? Thank you so much for coming to see us today. We'll be talking to you as we go forward trying to put our budget together for the
okay,
next
thank
years.
You. Appreciate it.
All right. Mentoring children of prisoners. While they're coming up to the table, members, our next hearing will be next Monday. And I think you've gotten an email with the... agenda for so far. Then we don't have a meeting on Wednesday. I think we're all at the Humphrey Institute that day. So, Ms. Lewis, are you going to start?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to see everyone here. You know, it made me think about the children shall be last, but that's okay because they'll be back as first. Okay. It's okay. I'm just very pleased to be here to just to report out to you about our Mentoring Children of Prisoners program. We've been very fortunate to have worked with the Department of Corrections for the past 2 years. We came to the department and asked several years ago about the ability to work with children of prisoners. We were very concerned as an organization. Mentoring is what we do, and that's all that we do, and it is the thing that we do best. But we also found out that the survey that was done among prisoners found out that 70% of those people incarcerated had a family member or a parent also were incarcerated before them. So our goal is to break the cycle, find a way to reach young people early enough that they will not take that same path. So we just came today to let you know a little bit about our success, the number of matches that we've made, the fact that 10% or more of our children are in this particular program. And in the state of Minnesota, there are 7,600 young people who could take advantage or should have the ability to take advantage of having a mentor because they have a parent or a close family member who is incarcerated. This is a bit of our program overview. Just to let you know that from January of 2007 and continuing through June of 2009, BBBS, Big Brothers Big Sisters, has served 367 new children, matching them with a volunteer, and now supports a total of 558 matches involving our mentoring children of prisoners. Now, we exceeded our goal that we gave to the Department of Corrections. So we have actually matched more children than we had originally thought our goal was to be. And that has a lot to do with the need there. It also has a lot to do with our ability to go out and find mentors who will work with our young people. I'd just like to say a couple more things before I introduce some very important people who are here with me today. And that is, we do a great deal of research with our children. And that research is something that is done on a national basis as well as on a local basis. And we look for three particular things in a child that we are working with. We look to see if they have confidence. We look to see if they are competent. And that has a lot to do with their academic performance and how they've improved and their classroom participation. And we look to see if they are caring. And I'm pleased to tell you that the data on the children who are in the Mentoring Children of Prisoners program is as good as or better than the children who are not in that program. So that says something about how children improve in their academics. It says something about how they improve in their classroom participation, how they stay away from delinquency, their avoidance of early parenting. It just says a lot about what happens when a mentor is in a child's life. And I think one of the most compelling things is that our children are showing a 95.3% for the capacity to care. That has a lot to do with whether you are concerned about other people, whether you will hurt someone, whether you care about yourself, or whether you want to go further in your life. And that's exactly what we know when we're working with children who are caring. Now, I'm going to stop at that, and I would love to introduce to you one of the caring people who is a big sister with us, and her little sister, Patricia, who is in our Mentoring Children of Prisoners program. And I'm going to let Darling Bell speak for herself, and I'm going to let Patricia, if she wants to say anything, as well. Well,
welcome to you both.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for having us.
Pull the microphone closer to you, please.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, for having us.
Sure.
First of all, I'd just like to say, as a big sister, it is, I don't think Patricia can get more out of this than I have thus far. I'm also the manager of community outreach and volunteer recruitment at Big Brothers Big Sisters. So it feels so great to be on both sides of the coin. I know what it is to be a mentor, and I also know what it is to be a mentee. And growing up in South Minneapolis, I had two parents in the house. I was blessed to have two parents in the household. But we had people at school, in the neighborhood, at church, in the community that mentored us. They weren't specifically called mentors, but they mentored us. That's why I do it, to just basically give back to my community, to stand in the gap. And we have a lot of our children who may not have two parents in the home, or some of them do, but some of them don't have two parents in the household. So I felt it was just my duty to give back to give back to these very children the same way someone gave back to me. So I don't have, I'm just overjoyed to be a big. I really am.
It's wonderful. Patricia, I'm so glad that you came to talk to us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, having Darlene as a big sister is like one of the best things that have like really ever happened to me. She has took me places that I have never been before, and she's expanding things that I like. She's expanding everything that I do, and that my grades are getting better and stuff. And I'm just like really proud to have her, and I know that she's loving and she treats me like family. And I don't know what I would be without her. And she's just like really special, and I love her a lot.
So, what's your favorite thing to do together?
Well, actually, my favorite thing at all is just hanging out with her. Just love being with her. It doesn't matter where we are. It's like we can just like talk for hours, and like doesn't matter where we go or if we're just like in the car just talking. We just love to talk, and I just love being around her.
Quite shy.
They are well matched.
I think so. Any questions for our testifiers? Senator Moi?
Well, you know, Madam Chair, I don't have a question, but I have a 15-year-old niece, and we do a lot of that, too. I don't have to be in the Big Sister program, but I'm big sister to my niece, and we do a lot of talking, so I know where you're coming from.
That qualifies you.
Patricia, how old are you?
I'm 13.
And where do you go to school?
Falcon Ridge in Napa Valley.
Ah, okay. And you'd be like in 8th grade?
7th.
7th grade? Okay. Wow. And have you made plans of what you're going to be when you're ready to go off and be in the professional world?
I was planning on being a lawyer.
Okay.
Good for you.
Good for you. We have a few lawyers at the table here. Senator Moi is a lawyer. And am I right that you were the first Hmong lawyer in the entire state of Minnesota?
Actually, no, that's not true. Although the first Hmong American lawyer in Minnesota came from the state here, and she's Eileen Herr, who is ED at the council, Asian Council.
All right, good. And we know her well. And Ken Back is here, who is what we call our committee attorney. He's smarter than everybody else that I can think of.
Oh, you're not too big.
Whenever I'm quite confused about where we should go, Mr. Backus always has an idea of what we can do to get around the...
Might not be a good idea.
Might not be a good idea, but it's an idea. Okay. And Representative Latz is an attorney, and his wife is an attorney as well.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd just like to say...
Speak of the devil, there she calls. Okay.
See?
Oh, I shouldn't characterize it that
way. No, probably not.
Speak of my loving co-counsel.
There you go. There you go.
Ms. Lewis.
That's better.
Because Patricia is being mentored by Big Brothers, Big Sisters, she will have the opportunity to go to college and possibly receive a full scholarship for her entire college education. We now have 52 young people going to college as a result of having been mentored by Big Brothers, Big Sisters. Special program, but Patricia, you stay there. You're going to be that lawyer.
Wow, that's wonderful. Now you have one more person at the table with
yes.
you.
I'm Deanna Nernberg, and I'm the Vice President of Research and Evaluation with Big Brothers Big Sisters. And I just wanted to share some of the details to follow up with what Ms. Lewis said. This program has been really important to the agency. In addition to being able to match couples like Darlene and her little sister Trish, we're able to provide extra services through this grant that have really helped many of the families and the littles and the couples matches to weather some difficult times that children are facing when they have a parent who's incarcerated. We have special trainings that we are able to offer, which we do offer to the parents as well as the bigs on how to deal with different situations. For instance, when the parent might be reentering the home, that's a very difficult time for matches and often for the family. And in this tough economic time, we're finding that we're often a very important resource to the families we serve. We've had numerous instances in the past few months of families that are suddenly finding themselves homeless and evicted, and we've been able to connect them through their big brothers and big sisters. They call our office. So the big is actually acting as an advocate for that child and that entire family so that they don't fall through the safety net. We connect them with United Way and other resources and are able to find them some supportive services that will make their lives easier and avoid some pretty difficult situations. At the same time that we are helping the children to continue to develop their assets, that's our primary focus, and helping parents develop skills related to avoiding substance abuse in children, avoiding teen parenting, helping them avoid gang activity, looking for signs and how to deal with those and identify situations.
Pretty important work. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lewis, or perhaps Ms. Bell, the public contributions in 07 was $1.8 million. Can you explain what that is? What is public contributions?
Our public contributions are a combination of donations from individuals, corporations and foundations, revenue from events and special activities.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Just out in greater Minnesota, and I'm sure Senator Ingebrigtsen has the same program. We have the kinship program, mm-hmm. too, and it's mm-hmm. and it's based off of what you've done with the Big Brothers Big Sisters, but it's imperative that those programs thrive. You know, issues are all the same with the children, basically. But I was a little astounded by the 41% male, 59% female.
In terms of mentors?
Yeah.
Yes.
For the children, wasn't it for the children?
For the children we've served in this program, one of the issues that BBBS faces, along with most other mentoring programs throughout the country, is our limiting factor is recruiting people who are willing to give up their time to be matched with children. And our greatest struggle is, along with most other mentoring programs, recruiting men who are willing to be mentors. And so once a child is over 10, we will only match them with someone of the same gender. If they're under 10, we will match a big sister with a younger little brother if the family is amenable to that. So the reason that we have a much larger number of boys who are on our waiting list waiting to be served. Children in the MCOP program do have the highest priority for being matched. Within the agency, we try to get these kids caring friends as soon as we can. But that's the reason for that discrepancy. One other thing I didn't mention, we do partner with BBBS in southern Minnesota, and so we do serve a pretty large service area, and that does encompass the majority of families who are dealing with incarcerated parents in the state.
Any other questions? Well, thank you all so much for coming today.
And thank you for your time and for your generosity for us to have this program.
And we'll be talking to you again soon, I'm sure. All right, thank you, members. Thank you for everyone in the audience. And if there's nothing else before us, I think we're adjourned.